Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
a new scientist cover story called Life's True Cradle from the 16th of June 2018, where I'm just honing up on my skills to read things. The byline is, "Was it Darwin's warm little pond, an exotic crater, lake, or icy shores?" Penny Satchett joins the epic hunt for the place where it all began. Nearly 4 billion years ago, the first life appeared on our planet. It would have looked like unlike any life as we know it today, more basic even than bacterial cells, barely more than a few genetic molecules packaged up in some kind of sack. Working out how it popped into existence is one of our greatest intellectual endeavours, and at the root of the problem is an epic hunt for the perfect location. Researchers studying the origin of life each have their favourite spots. Some sites offer the right molecular ingredients, others provide ready-made little containers to hold these early reactions. But it's possible that one special place had a perfect combination of all the conditions essential for all the chemistry of life. And does a simple place still exist today, on Earth or elsewhere in the universe? Charles Darwin kicked off the quest. In a letter he wrote to a botanist, Joseph Dalton Hooker, in 1871, he described a hypothetical warm little pond rich with chemicals and salts and a source of light, heat, electricity. He imagined that such an environment, proteins might spontaneously form, ready to turn into something more complex. In the 1950s, chemists Stanley Miller and Harold Urey managed to create Darwin's pond in a lab. They mixed water together with gases they thought would have been present in the early Earth, and zapped them with stimulated lightning. It produced amino acids, the building blocks of all proteins. Basic supplies. Their experiments is one of the most famous of the last century, but we now know that what they created, protein components in water, is not enough to constitute life. To truly get going, life would have needed three quite special features: a genetic code that would carry the blueprint for making cells, a chemical system or metabolism to generate energy to power the cells, and a sac or membrane to hold it all together. In organisms alive today, the trio built from the same atoms, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. So, at the most basic level, life's crucible must have offered a ready supply of these atoms and the right conditions for them to come together and form all three of life's essential features. While biochemists were pondering these matters, deep sea explorers made a surprising discovery in the Pacific. In 1979, a US submersible Alvin was diving at a volcanic ridge at 2 kilometers beneath the surface when it discovered black smokers, underwater vents spewing superheated water at 350 degrees Celsius. These were host to a whole ecosystem unlike any that had been seen before. The find was fortuitous. At the time when biologists were trying to imagine what life not as we know it might look like, there was living, thriving examples. There were some very alien, ancient-looking fauna living around the black smokers, says Philip Hogger at the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge, UK. Coincidentally, only 2 years later, Voyager 2 space probe was sparking interest in the possibility of extraterrestrial life and its origins by sending back photos of Jupiter's icy moon Europa. People thought it could have subsurface oceans with vents, says Holger. Their speculation fueled excitement that deep hydrothermal vents could have kick-started life elsewhere as well as on Earth. The idea is still fixed in the public imagination, even though researchers have long since left it behind. There are relatively few people defending black smokers as the place life started, says Nick Lane at the University College London. The problem is that they are low in hydrogen and too hot for nascent molecules to stay intact for long. In particular, RNA, a molecule that many evolutionist biologists think has served as life's genetic material before DNA, degrades rapidly at high temperature. Then came the discovery in 2000 of cooler submarine vents in the mid-Atlantic. The site, christened the Lost City, was a collection of alkaline hydrothermal vents. Here, seawater reacts with the minerals in the seawater to produce rocks that are riddled with tiny pores, as well as a warm fluid that is rich in hydrogen. Vane thinks the rocky pores would have been ideal for reactions of early life. In particular, electrochemical gradient between the alkaline vent and the fluid and the acidic seawater back then could have led to spontaneous formation of acetyl phosphate and pyrophosphate, two molecules that act just like ATP, the chemical that powers living cells today. The rest of the essentials could have been followed, says Lane. Acetyl phosphate and pyrophosphate could have provided the energy to synthesize the first organic molecules from dissolved carbon dioxide and hydrogen gas. From these, the building blocks of proteins and RNA might have been made. If lipids had been made too, they may have coated the inside of the pores to form the first cell membranes. Alkaline ocean vents are great in the way they offer a ready-made metabolism to run life's first reaction, but they have a problem. They are too wet, says Davis Deemer, the University of California in Santa Cruz. Proteins, genetic materials, and lipids are polymers, chains made from respective building blocks. Way back when things were just getting started, biomolecules were painfully rare, something that had to stop the building blocks being too diluted, unable to bump into each other and form change. The answer, says Deemer, is a place with wet and dry cycles to bring things together. If you have cycles, you have natural experiments going on again and again, thousands and times, until something interesting happens. There's another argument in favour of life starting on land. In the environment that dried up periodically, dehydration plays a key role in making organic molecules. Every time a building block is added to a growing chain, a molecule of water is released. Enzymes control the process in modern cells. Without enzymes to help, a drier environment would have encouraged such reactions at life's early stages. Dreamer imagines volcanic islands with fresh water pools sprayed by hot springs of geyser in between drying out. These pools could have been good places for the first fatty membranes, much better than the deep sea vents. When the ocean dissolved, calcium and magnesium ions could have stopped the fatty acids coming together to make continuous membrane. But in freshwater, lipids easily coalesce in the same way as oily drops clump together when you mix oil and water. Desert origins. Deemer's team has been taking samples from hot springs at Yellowstone National Park and Bumpus Hill in Mount Layson National Park, California, and putting them through the wet-dry cycles. In unpublished work, they have found that if they dry out these samples and then rehydrate them, the RNA molecules can become encapsulated in thin, fappy membranes resembling genetic material within rudimentary protocells. In a slight twist to the hot pool scenario, Armin Maljukajam of Onnesbruck University, Germany, prefers an even drier environment in the form of geothermal fields, hot rocks that release water vapors heated by geological activity inside the earth. His team argues that chemistry there is similar to what goes on in rich elements important for life, says Maljukajam. As vapor condenses, some experiments suggest the tiny droplets can form and create the ideal conditions for components of RNA to materialize. However, to make RNA, you first need to make the sugar ribose, the R in RNA. The atoms for that would probably have been available in the atmosphere, but tend to form something other than ribose unless given a helping hand. Borate minerals could have done the job. According to Stephen Beckner, the Foundation of Applied Molecular Evolution in Florida, they guide reactions towards producing ribose. And better still, they stop ribose from falling apart. Beckner thinks this makes deserts an appealing candidate for life's cradle. The rocks are rich in borates, and the occasional rains would have leached them out. If you have been in Death Valley, you've seen an example of what we have in mind. One thing all the environments have in common is heat. This makes sense in the warmer temperatures can help power chemical reactions. It comes as a bit of a surprise that some researchers think that it could have been ice. When water freezes, everything dissolves and it gets hydrated. and concentrated into Brian, says Holger. Brian gets trapped in narrow cracks and cracks in the ice. The polymer chains form and the cool temperatures help stabilize biomolecules long enough for them to keep on growing. Researchers have experimented with making long RNA strands by freezing a solution of its building blocks together in metal ions. These ions are common in the environment and help catalyze the reactions. Holger and his colleagues have also found a repeated freeze-thaw cycle that builds enzymes made of RNA. That's key because enzymes themselves can make more RNA strands, precisely the kind of setup that you might expect in early life. I think ice is an interesting medium to facilitate that important transition towards a system that can propagate itself. All these land freshwater scenarios have a catch. Unlike Lane's alkaline vents, they don't offer an easy explanation for how metabolism evolved. They all lack a convincing hypothesis for how all three parts of early life, genetic material, metabolism, and membranes, came together. Everyone's pretty much agreed on the 50-odd years ago that they couldn't get everything done in one go, says John Sutherland of the MRC Laboratory of Microbiology. Most researchers fall into one of two camps, depending on whether they focus on genetics or metabolism when looking at the origins of life. Genetics or metabolism. Sutherland's team is seeking a scenario that creates everything in one place at one time. Reliably set out to look for chemistry that would make all the various bits and pieces, he said. That led them to meteorite impacts, which would have been common 4 billion years ago. The rocks from outer space could have brought hydrogen cyanides with them, a convenient source of the three essential elements in the organic molecules carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. Sutherland's experiments show that the accumulation of hydrogen cyanide became superheated then by other meteorite impacts. The presence of water and UV light, they could have formed a whole suite of precursor molecules for RNA, proteins, and lipids. There's a snag, though. No life uses cyanide as a source of either carbon or nitrogen, says Lane. So was life's cradle wet, dry, or frozen? I don't think these are mutually exclusive, said Hollinger. For example, Sutherland's meteor impact chemistry needs at least one wet-dry cycle and hydrogen sulfide, both of which could have been provided by hydrothermal activity and hot fresh water pools, a kind of environment Gemma thinks is good for membranes. One place all this could have come together is a hydrothermal lake inside a meteorite crater. You know that when the big meteorite hits, it fissures the crust, says Sutherland. If water pools in the crater, it can percolate down the cracks and go deep enough inside the earth to be heated and bubble up again. Hydrothermal craters, lakes would have been abundant on the protocontinents of the young Earth, says Sankar Chatterjee of Texas Tech University. Why stop here? Throw in ice around the edges, like you see in Yellowstone in winter, and nearby terrestrial alkaline hydrothermal vents, similar to those at the bottom of the ocean, but on land. And you might get Hollinger's self-sustaining RNA enzymes and Lane's ready-made metabolism. Everything you need is wrapped up in one place. Thanks for listening.